Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ballerinas will tend to lose their hair around the edges, so the front, around the ears and at the back. Gotcha. So all those areas that have been pulled really tight. And I suppose anybody that had a Croydon facelift in the 90s would also experience that kind of hairless as well.
Right, yeah.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast, the show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. My name is Dr. Rupi. I'm a medical doctor. I also study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me on this podcast where we explore multiple determinants of what allows you to live your best life. And remember, you can sign up to thedoctorskitchen.com for the newsletter where we give weekly recipes plus tips and hacks on how to improve your lifestyle today. On the episode, we have Dr. Ingrid Wilson. She is the director of True Hair and Skin Clinic, which primarily helps people with hair loss, scalp problems, and skin concerns. She's also been a general practitioner in the NHS for 20 years, and this gives her a helpful insight into what is actually available so that she can provide a service which is accessible and recognizes the challenges of long NHS waiting times and the limits of what's actually funded in terms of cosmetic treatments in the NHS. She's one of the few trichologists in the country that are actually able to prescribe for hair loss conditions, and she also participated in a panel discussion at the House of Commons on the epidemic of hair loss in Black women to share the GP's perspective, and has spoken at several events about hair loss and regularly writes on the subject matter as well. She's also a member of the Primary Care Dermatology Society, the British Hair and Nail Society, the International Association of Trichologists. Basically, she is the perfect person to be talking about eating for hair, because not only does she take a scientific approach to the process of seeing patients in her clinic, but she really does take heed of the lifestyle and holistic nature of the subject matter. On today's podcast, we talk about a whole range of different topics, how you can separate different types of hair loss into temporary and permanent hair loss, the diagnostic process, and actually what other things could be underlying hair loss as a symptom, the hair cycle, the number of hairs that you actually lose every day. I was quite shocked to find out how many. The nutritional requirements for good hair. One thing that we always look through the lens of in this episode is how hair is almost like a luxury item, i.e. when you nourish your body with food, it's going to fuel parts of your body and your physiology that actually require the nutrients to survive. So your liver, your kidney, hydration, before any nutrients are delivered to your hair on your scalp. And this is something that's quite important, because I think hair and hair issues can be almost like the canary in the coal mine for any nutritional issues that you might be suffering from. We talk about a trichotest, a new genomic test that can deliver a few more insights into the causes behind certain hair loss issues. We talk about the pharmaceutical interventions with hair loss, both topical and oral. We also talk about different ways in which we can improve grey hair and the other issues that, you know, people have asked me about loads of times, but because I don't have a specialist interest or area expertise in this area, having Dr. Ingrid on was just wonderful. I learned a lot from this episode, and I'm sure you will too. Before the episode, we sat down, had a chat, and we ate lunch. And the lunch I cooked for her was one of my new recipes from the book 321, three portions of fruit and vegetables per person, two servings per recipe, and only using one pan. I actually cooked it in less than 30 minutes before she arrived, so I was quite happy with myself. And she seemed to like it. So if you want those recipes, do check out thedoctorskitchen.com. Sign up to the newsletter where I'll be giving a bit more information about that. And do check the website where we're going to do some articles on eating for hair as well as eating for a whole other range of conditions. I'm going to be quiet now. This is quite a long episode, about an hour. And I hope you enjoy this conversation I had with Dr. Ingrid. First of all, how was your lunch?
The lunch was absolutely delicious.
You don't have to say that.
No, it was lovely. I you know, any food that somebody cooks for me is always delicious.
I know it's not what you typically eat. You told me about your diet and, you know, what you prefer and stuff. But I hope that, you know, this could become a staple in your house. You never know.
Do you know what? I do like chickpeas and I like pulses as well. I like pulses in general as well. Okay. So I love mung beans. They're absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it's one of my
and
favorites.
Coriander is my favorite herb, actually.
Brilliant.
So,
you know, mine's lovely. Tarragon.
Is it?
yeah, it's a little bit of an odd one, but I'm getting into dill recently.
I love dill. Well, I told you about my dill plant, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the kibashi.
The bokashi.
That's it.
That gave it potent growth potential.
Yeah. I'm going to try that for sure. So we were talking a bit earlier about how I found you. And I was talking about the whole process that I go behind, you know, approaching guests and stuff. And I trawl through different websites, different bodies, and I try and get someone who's got a medical background, who understands, you know, the process by which we as GPs go through removing or making sure that we're not missing red flags. Someone who has a nutrition and lifestyle slant, and then someone who has a specialist interest in something. So I came across you, I approached you, we had a conversation, and I'm really excited about this podcast because I get asked about hair a lot.
Oh, okay.
I was going to ask you to give a little background into your general practice career, but then also how you got into trichology.
Yeah, so I trained in Liverpool. I did my GP training in the Mersey region. It was really, you know, really enjoyable. I was a salary GP for about 9 months, actually, which was quite a short period of time, I know, but the opportunity came to train in public health.
Oh, brilliant.
So I only just applied the once and I got onto the public health training scheme. So I know that people did try for many years to try and get on the scheme, so I was quite lucky to just get on it first time. And so I just went through the scheme in the Cheshire Merseyside area for 5 years. And then when the scheme finished, there was a big reorganisation of the NHS. So there were no consultant jobs.
Right.
So stayed on for an extra year. But during that time, I returned to general practice. So I sort of did a part-time GP returner scheme. And during that GP returner scheme, I also did a little bit of dermatology learning as well.
Right.
And I did a week's course at, I think it was Salford or Manchester, but it was a week's course. And it was terrifying because I thought, gosh, I really don't know as much dermatology as I thought I did. Yeah. And it just sort of started me on this journey of wanting to learn as much as I could about skin problems.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then the interest in trichology came after sort of personal experience of hair loss and realizing that I wasn't really able to help people as a GP as much as I wanted to.
Right.
Because I think most people can recognize balding. Most GPs can, most members of the public can. But then there are those other conditions that you sort of think, what on earth is that?
Yeah.
And so about sort of 2010, I decided to look for a course to just try and improve my knowledge.
Okay.
But I couldn't find one for GPs, so I decided to go and train with the Institute of Trichologists. So I did a two-year distance course with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was mainly sort of correspondence. You did essays, and which got marked, and you go down to their centre at Tooting.
Yeah, yeah.
And get some teaching and do some practical sessions as well. So that was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since then, how has that had an impact on your medical career? Because you also do GP appraisals as well, so you're still very much focused on the medical aspect of everything.
Yeah, I mean, the hair stuff, it's sort of peripheral to my mainstream general practice because I think in the typical GP consultation, you just don't really have enough time to go into hair loss conditions in the way that you'd like to. Because people need a lot from you when they're experiencing hair loss, which there just isn't time for. So there's all the psychological stuff that's going on. There's the physical problems that you've got to exclude. You don't really get time to go into the nutrition,
which ideally
you would. And then there's the practical side, wigs, hair pieces, hair camouflage. You just don't have time to do that in a typical consultation.
Yeah.
So I sort of see the hair loss work that I do was slightly separate to general practice and appraisals and things.
Ideally, would you like to do more of it, do you think?
definitely. Yeah. Because every time I start on some endeavor around hair, I end up delving really, really deep into it and thinking, oh, this is really interesting. Where can I go with this?
Yeah.
And so, it's been definitely been an adventure.
Yeah.
And what I've been finding is that since lockdown, when I've moved to virtual consultations, I've changed the model that I use to consult with people. Mm. So I'll do a 30 to 60 minute consultation with them.
Okay. That sounds like the dream.
Yeah.
30 to 60 minute consult.
That's it. Amazing. Because normally it's five. It's effectively 5 minutes, even though it's actually a 10 minute consultation.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got 30 to 60 minutes with them. But then that will also be preceded by them sending me photographs of the condition. I'll ask them to complete a short questionnaire, which includes some psychological questions, and that can throw up some surprises as well, because hair loss can really deeply affect people. I'll ask them about what hair products they're using, the supplements that they're using as well, because you would be amazed, some people take loads of supplements in the hope that it will help their hair. And so I've got all that information before the consultation. We do the consultation, and then there'll be some form of communication afterwards.
Definitely.
So normally I send them an email summarizing what I've found and what I recommend.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a model that we need to adopt for all conditions, really. Like being armed with that sort of knowledge prior to your consultation as a GP would be game-changing. I mean, having emails and images and, you know, the whole psychological assessment is brilliant. Very, really good. So it's good to know that there are resources out there. I thought like we could start by defining exactly what we mean by hair loss, the different types of hair loss, and perhaps what you see most of as well from your experience in trichology.
Okay, well, I suppose people mean different things by hair loss. So some people will notice that there's some thinning in some areas. So for example, if you're experiencing balding related to age, you'll notice some thinning at the top and the temples in men, and at the top in women. I'd say that there are two main categories of hair loss. One is temporary causes, and the others are more permanent, which we call scarring, alopecias, alopecia being a general term for hair loss. So the types of hair loss that we think of as being temporary are androgenetic alopecia, or what we call male and female pattern hair loss, which is due to age, genetics, and gender. Then you've got telogen effluvium, which is basically hair shedding. And so that's when you'll see lots of hairs on the pillow, in the shower, all over the house. And then you've got alopecia areata, which is an autoimmune hair loss condition. And that is a very unpredictable hair loss condition. But in the majority of cases, it's reversible. Most, about 80% of people will recover their hair at a year. But there will be an unfortunate minority who will go on to lose all the hair on their scalp. Some people lose it on other parts of their bodies, like their eyebrows and other parts as well.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And then you've got the permanent hair forms of hair loss. I understand the form that's the most common that's seen in hair loss clinics by dermatologists at the moment is one called frontal fibrosing alopecia.
Okay.
I don't know if that's one that, I don't think it's something that GPs may be that aware of.
No.
But what it looks like is it's quite a high hairline.
Okay.
So you've got sort of, it's almost like a band of hair loss at the front. And sometimes it gets confused with traction alopecia, which is a form of hair loss that's due to tight pulling hairstyles.
So, okay.
And that's, and I think part of the reason that GPs haven't heard about it is because it was only really recognised in 1994.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so it's quite a new condition. And I hadn't actually heard of it until I did the trichology course. And there are lots of theories about why it started now. There are theories about, could it be sunscreen, the use of sunscreen?
Oh, interesting.
Could it be the use of antibiotics or contraceptives? There have been some GWAS, genome-wide studies, which have found some associations with the condition because it has been noted that it runs in families.
Oh, interesting.
So I think the most important thing that people need to be aware of is that there are temporary forms of hair loss that are fairly straightforward to treat, and then the more permanent causes, which they need to be referred on to a dermatologist.
Yeah.
Because the cosmetic appearance can be very significant for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And just to talk about the pulling alopecia related to hairstyles, does that impact certain people from different backgrounds? I mean, I know I'm thinking about my own Punjabi heritage. I come from a Sikh background where we have turbans, and I remember my dad used to have a turban, would tie his long hair very, very tight at the front. And I remember, you know, seeing my granddad, and he had quite a high hairline as well. And I wonder whether it's distinct to certain people.
Yes, it can affect everyone, but it's mainly the hair care practices that are associated with it. So for people with a Sikh background, a tightly tied turban can cause hair loss in those areas where there's been that long-term pulling.
Yeah.
So it's not like plucking
where
your hair will just grow back. Yeah. It's that slow, repeated tension.
Yeah.
So many wear turbans, and I suppose young boys, they wear, is it the gut?
Or we call it a jorda, I think.
You have a little
knot on the top.
Yes. So there are actually reports in the BMJ from the 1970s talking about traction alopecia in Sikh boys.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I should dig that up.
Yes. Yeah. Medline is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Other groups that are affected, ballerinas.
Oh, really?
Because they've got their hair tied up really tight.
Interesting. Okay.
So I sort of supply wigs from a large wig retailer, and they actually provide hair pieces that are designed to fit around those areas of hair loss, because ballerinas will tend to lose their hair around the edges, so the front, around the ears and at the back.
Gotcha.
So all those areas that have been pulled really tight. And I suppose anybody that had a Croydon facelift in the 90s would also experience that kind of hair loss as well.
Right, yeah.
But more seriously, it is something that affects Black women quite fairly commonly as well. And we're not really quite sure whether there's a genetic component to it. Mm. Are there fewer anchoring fibrils in the dermis? Is it to do with the curved hair follicle?
Mm.
But hair care practices do play a part as well. So there have been quite a few studies done in South Africa around this. That seems to, in the sort of the black populations in South Africa, has been where most of the work on traction alopecia has been done.
Oh, wow.
And they found that it gets more common as you get older. Mm. There's a strong association with hair care practices. If you relax or chemically straighten your hair, that increases the risk. And if you sort of use styles that will cause repeated traction or pulling, such as braids or weaves on top of that relaxed style, then that will increase your chances. And actually during the lockdown period, I have come across quite a few women who I think have had to confront this issue because obviously not had access to the hairdresser and various ways of concealing the hair. So
I mean, I this is all very new to me, as you can already tell. Like, you know, I'm not aware of like beauty practices and all that kind of stuff amongst different populations. But this is really interesting, and I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about the certain treatments of hair, like the relaxation, the chemical straightening, but even everyday hair products as well that are available. Is there any association with certain products that we should steer clear of, or ones that we should perhaps entertain?
Well, to be honest, I know I'm more aware of what's going on for people with more curly Afro textured hair, because I think that's where the attention has been paid to this condition, including by organisations like L'Oreal. So there's a new resource called Africa Derm that's recently been launched. That's published in patient information leaflets about it, and they talk about using sulfate-free shampoos because they're less drying. So it's there's still a lot of work to be done. I think there's still a lot of unknowns, but there are certain known things like the relaxing of the hair and the pulling styles, but I'm not so sure about the association with certain products. One thing that they did find in South Africa was if you relaxed or chemically straightened your hair and then used a colour or coloured the hair within 2 weeks, that was also associated with traction alopecia.
Gotcha. Mm. Okay, fine. So it's hairstyles, certain products, and obviously there's other associations like you just mentioned, you know, wide associations, but we'll talk about that a bit later for sure. So I thought perhaps we should talk about the first sort of category of temporary hair loss. How do we approach temporary hair loss, and how do we make sure that we're removing it from perhaps an underlying medical condition that could be related to hair loss in itself?
I suppose the first thing is making sure that you're sure of the diagnosis. So each form of hair loss will have its own particular way of presenting. So for example, male pattern hair loss, it's got quite a classic way of progressing. So it will start at the temples and then progress back. It will also start at the top and sort of progress down. So I suppose we're used to seeing that on many different people. Likewise, in women, they go bald in a different way. So they keep the front of their hairline, but they've just got a wider parting at the centre. It just looks thinner.
Okay.
Yeah. So from the top view, that's where you'll start to see most of the changes. So recognition is the main issue. I think with men, it's sort of almost seen as an accepted part of aging. So some men are even starting to lose their hair in their late teens, early 20s. Whereas for women, if they're starting to lose their hair in that female pattern hair loss way, there may be an underlying problem like polycystic ovarian syndrome, or in the worst cases, even an androgen secreting tumour that could be responsible for that kind of hair loss at an early age.
Would you see quite drastic hair loss with those sort of conditions?
Yes, you can see very extreme. And it's amazing because people hide it very well. They may wear a wig or something called a topper, which is sort of a smaller wig that you put on the top. And they'll have been hiding it from people for a long time. So I do come across people who have hidden it from their families. They won't be seen without a wig or a head covering. So that's very significant.
Yeah.
Alopecia areata. I remember that's the one where you get the circular patches of hair loss. And I think that's the one that GPs probably see the most.
Yeah, we do. I see a lot of that.
Yeah. And it's often, I notice stress seems to be a trigger.
Interesting. I'm used to doing sort of psychological assessments.
Yeah.
I always try and ask some sensitive questions about, you know, has anything changed over the last year, or, you know, have you had any struggles or anything like that? I notice if I have to be quite careful about the vernacular. If you ask someone if they're stressed, no, I'm not stressed. No, of course I'm fine. But there are some underlying features I find of a number of different conditions, apart from hair as well, where stress definitely is a contributing factor or something that is conveniently preceding a symptom.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there is an association with autoimmune conditions as well, but the way when I see it presenting it, there normally seems to be some sort of event, might be a breakup or stress at work or stress in studies that might have triggered it. And then the other, telogen effluvium, is the third main cause of temporary hair loss, and that's basically hair shedding. So the reason why it's called telogen effluvium is it relates to the hair cycle. So in your hair has got a growth of cycle and shedding. So the growth phase is called anagen. So that's when the hair is being nourished, it's continually growing, and that normally lasts about 1,000 days. It may vary from race to race, so some people have a longer growth phase than others. Then you've got sort of a shorter transitional phase called catagen, which lasts 10 days, and then the final phase, where the hair is resting in the hair follicle just waiting to fall out, that's called telogen. And the effluvium basically means shedding. So a classic story is somebody will contact me saying, I'm just shedding hair. And then when you go back in the story and you ask them about their health or anything that's been going on in their life, there's usually something that's happened about 4 months before the hair started shedding.
Interesting.
Might be illness, sometimes even crash dieting, but or some major stress, divorce, death, something like that.
How does one differentiate between what is regarded as a normal amount of hair shedding versus something that could be pathological, whether it be related to something like stress, or whether there's some underlying endocrinology issue going on? I mean, for example, whenever I go have a shower, I'm always pulling out bits of hair. And to me, that's sort of normal.
That is normal.
How do we get the balance, and how do you adjust for that?
I suppose it's worth knowing that we lose about 50 to 100 hairs every day.
Every day.
Which sounds a lot more.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? I think people who make vacuum cleaners will probably attest to that we lose hair all over the place when we don't necessarily realize it.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think most people and also there are seasonal changes in hair shedding as well. So around this time of year, late summer, early autumn, people actually shed more hair. But people may notice a problem when you suddenly see that there's hairs all over the pillows, hairs all over the home, clogging up the shower, the plug hole or whatever.
Yeah,
and that's when they notice that there's a problem.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so with tea in particular, and I think this is something that, what is most common in terms of the different types of temporary hair loss? Which is one that you see perhaps most often?
I think it's actually balding. Up until lockdown, it was young men who... they looked across the dinner table, saw their male relatives, and thought, I'm starting to lose my hair. I better do something about it. And I think previous generations found it easier to accept hair loss. But I suppose we live in a more social media conscious society now.
Absolutely.
And people are much more conscious of their appearance. And I think those early 20s are very, very important for people from the image point of view, because Whereas maybe back in the 90s, if a man was losing his hair, he'd shave it off.
Yeah.
Now they're thinking, oh, should I have a hair transplant? And and also I think hair transplants are being actively targeted to young men in their 20s as well.
Yeah.
And so there's this whole market that exists abroad that's encouraging younger men to go and get hair transplants.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I definitely agree with we as a society have definitely become a lot more image conscious, and I think that's definitely playing a huge part into where people go to seek ways in which to help their image and whatever. But that's definitely something I've noticed amongst my colleagues. I'm quite blessed to have hair and a thick head of hair. Loads of people tell me that, and a lot of my friends always ask me about what I do in terms of, you know, hair products, and I don't think, perhaps I'm being generous, but if this was 20 years ago and I was 35, I don't think they'd be having this conversation.
No, I think my other half, he doesn't have any hair.
Oh, right.
He came, you know, about 20 years ago, he came to that point where he thought, I haven't got much hair.
Yeah.
So he just shaved it off. And at the time, Phil Mitchell, the Mitchell brothers. So, you know, shaving your hair off was not not a big issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Mm. But before we go into sort of nutrition, supplementation and lifestyle practices to help with hair shedding, I wonder if we could talk a bit more about this particular medical conditions that might be associated. So we've talked about PCOS, we talked about chronic stress, I guess that could tip into the sort of psychiatric sphere of why people might have hair loss. What other things do we need to be aware of?
I think lupus. Actually, yeah, because that can present as areas of hair loss. That's a potentially scarring or permanent form of hair loss. Mm-hmm. Of course, that needs to be seen by a dermatologist who can manage the hair loss condition, but also all the other manifestations of it as well.
Interesting. And you mentioned crash dieting as well, so like very low calorie diets, or people on a bit of a phase where they try and rapidly lose weight for summer or something like that. Does that have an impact?
They will get, or they're more likely to get telogen effluvium.
Gotcha.
So they're more likely to get hair shedding, and that's just us because of the nutritional deficiencies associated with it as well. Because even though, yes, there are benefits to losing weight, you'll lose out on all those micronutrients and macronutrients as well.
So people who are trying to perhaps go on a very low calorie diet, perhaps just calorie counting without really looking at the micronutrient deficiencies, may put themselves at risk of this. And I mean, it's definitely something I've seen anecdotally in general practice, but I didn't realize how what the mechanism might be behind that. And I guess it's because it's impacting the hair cycle.
Yes. I suppose when you think about it, the hair is almost a luxury, if you like.
Yeah.
Because when we're taking these nutrients into our body, they're focusing on other processes. Gotcha. They're prioritizing other processes first.
Yeah.
And so hair is kind of at the back of the queue when it comes.
That's such a good way of looking at it. That really is. So it's like, we're going to sort out everything else first. We're going to make sure your liver's functioning, your kidney's functioning, your hydration status is optimal. The last thing we're going to do is make sure that you've got a luscious mane.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
That's just evolution.
Interesting.
Okay, great. So let's get into the lifestyle elements of it and nutrition. What ways are there that are evidence-based? Are there which we can sort of make sure we have, you know, thick, strong hair, and we are trying to reduce the amount of shedding and the opportunity for the other temporary causes of hair loss?
I suppose the basic principle is more or less what you espouse, which is that you've got to have a wide range of foods, different food groups, different colours. But you need protein. Mm-hmm. And you can get protein from meat and fish, but you can also get it from vegetarian sources as well, as you know. Yeah. because hair is based, is mainly protein. It's 88% keratin, which is a protein. Mm. You also need fats, a little bit of fat in the diet. It helps to keep the hair in the hair follicle, almost putting it very simplistically. You need carbohydrates, but you need the right kind of carbohydrates. So not the refined sugars and things like that, because that will impact adversely on the scalp environment. Then you need vitamins, minerals, and of course water. Mm. So as long as you have a balanced diet that fits in with the needs of general health, I think hair health will generally follow.
Yeah.
So what I tend to do when I see people is I talk to them, I find out what their diet is like, and just pick up any big red flags that might be missing. So, and again, you can get some quite interesting surprises. So people who may look healthy to you, they might go to the gym and exercise. Their diet may be just completely bland or white and brown food. And so, of course, that's not going to be great for the health of their hair.
Do you think many trichologists or maybe even dermatologists or people who are performing the surgical transplants for hair assess nutrition and lifestyle prior to offering those services? Is it something that's sort of standard? Or
I don't know if it's standard, but I think that some are starting to think about it.
Okay.
So I think what's happening now is that because hair transplants have become more well established, they're now building up quite a good evidence base around it. And actually the hair restorations, there are some hair restoration surgeons in the UK that are really leading the way in terms of hair education. Mm. And I think what they're finding is that to enhance their results, it's not just about being a great surgeon.
Absolutely.
It's about making sure that that environment is perfect and that you will maintain the results.
Yeah.
So some surgeons, they do platelet-rich plasma treatments into the scalp where your plasma is spun down. So your blood is taken, you're spun down, and so the plasma is taken off, and which is rich in platelets and injected. And they're using that to support hair growth. Some are using medications to support hair growth as well. So I think it will vary, like anything, from surgeon to surgeon. But I'm starting to hear more about a more holistic approach being taken.
Yeah, I think this is sort of happening across the board. I know there's some pilots going on with both bariatric surgery, but also general surgery. So we have a prehab where you optimize your patient, not just from a weight perspective, but from a micronutrient perspective. And then you also have a post-surgical sort of program where people are made sure to have vitamin E-rich foods and all the different sorts of micronutrients that would aid wound healing as well.
Absolutely.
And I think it's very important from the perspective of hair, particularly as we alluded to earlier, how it's a luxury. So you're going to make sure you're really hot on your diet and your lifestyle before those nutrients will be actually, you know, directed, for want of a better term, towards hair follicles.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. With regard to protein, so we talked about like how you can get a full complement of the 9 essential amino acids from meat products. You can also get that from vegan sources, plant-based sources, so chickpeas, brown rice, the combinations of different plant protein-rich plant-based items. Are there particular proteins or amino acids that may be more useful for hair, from the perspective of hair growth?
I think it's all about balance, to be honest. Yeah, there are specific ones that related to hair growth, but I don't think people need to necessarily think about it in that way. I know there are a lot of supplements out there that say have this type of protein, but the evidence for certain supplements is not that great. There are a few that I'm aware of where there are some studies that sort of objectively measure before and afters of using using certain supplements, but I personally at this point in time I don't think people need to go into that much detail.
with fats, omega-3, particularly the long chain omega-3, so EPA and DHA, which we know may have benefits from a cardiovascular perspective and a brain perspective, as well as inflammation overall. Are those types of fats useful from the perspective of
yes, omega-3s, and to a lesser extent, omega-6s as well, but mainly omega-3s are seen as being beneficial. So,
interesting. Okay. And so the foods that we're talking about there are like fatty fish and mackerel and sardines. And there are plant-based sources of omega-3, but those are the short-chain omega-3. So perhaps a little bit harder to get from a vegan diet. With types of diet in general, one of the things that I got back from the Q&A that I put out before the pod was people either raving about a completely 100% plant-based diet, a vegan diet, being fantastic for the hair, and others with the complete opposite. Is there anything about that particular diet that could be harmful or beneficial to certain people?
I think the key thing is vitamin B12, isn't it, really? I think that's the key, because lack of vitamin B12 is associated with hair loss and hair growing, interestingly enough. So I think that's the main thing that I can see from the diet.
Anything about vitamin A? The vegan diet has a lot of pro-retinal vitamins, so beta carotenes and the carotenoids, but the conversion of that into the preformed vitamin A that you find in meat products is quite low. Is there any evidence around vitamin A supplementation that you're aware of in terms of hair?
It's not something that I would recommend, actually, because in excess it's associated with hair loss.
So
I don't think, again, that I think people often take supplements not necessarily knowing, understanding what the potential detriment could be, but vitamin A, no, I wouldn't recommend that.
I've had some anecdotes actually of people taking vitamin A and actually not being good for the hair, but I guess it depends on the person as well. If they've isolated an issue, then perhaps it could be beneficial, but not as a blanket rule. Supplements, let's talk about that. As we're sort of alluding to that at the moment, what ones do you think may have some benefits, and what ones are being touted as beneficial but lack that sort of evidence base behind them?
I think that there are two supplements that sort of stand out as having an evidence base. So one is Viviscal, and the other one is Pantagar. I would say I know more about Viviscal because that's one that I do recommend in the right circumstances. And the background to that is that it was recognised that Eskimo people had very good quality hair, and that was thought to be due to their diet, which was rich in fish. So essentially what they did was they took the fish protein, improved it, and use this as the basis of their supplements. There were other things in it as well, but it's mainly the fish protein. And there are some small trials that do show an objectively measured benefit. And then there's another one that I'm aware of called Pantagar, but I don't have much experience with that. But I have seen people report some benefit from Viviscal. But there are a lot of supplements out there. But I'd say, being absolutely as a responsible prescriber, vitamin D, I would say, is the one that people need to make sure that they've got the right levels of that, because low vitamin D levels are associated with certain hair loss conditions. So the androgenetic alopecia, melanoma pattern hair loss, the telogen effluvium, and alopecia areata. It's not known 100% whether low vitamin D levels cause it, but there's definitely an association. So the recommendation is that if you've got a low vitamin D level and you've got these conditions, then it would make sense to supplement, and also for bone health, of course. And I think the only other supplement that I would regularly recommend, depending on what the issue was, would be an iron supplement, because iron deficiency is one of the commonest causes of anemia worldwide, whether that's due to diet or in women of childbearing age due to periods. And of course, as we know, you can lose your iron through other means as well. But you do see in the world of hair loss, we look at the ferritin levels a lot, and ferritin is a measure of your overall iron stores, and try and keep those at optimum levels.
I remember the paper you sent to me about ferritin and the potential use of L-lysine in combination with iron replacement, and that being helpful for certain people.
Yes, I believe that that research is also the basis of one of the more famous forms of supplementation that includes iron. And that is one I recommend to people as well. In that situation. So women with chronic telogen, effluvium, chronic hair loss that's associated with low iron stores, I would recommend that to them.
And you do some work with genomic testing as well, because I wanted to talk a bit about selenium and folate as some of the other potential supplements. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because I'm not familiar with genomic testing at this point. I don't use it because I'm working in A&E.
But it's coming into the nutritional world as well, I believe.
Massively, yeah. So I've done a podcast with a colleague of mine who's a nutrigenomic practitioner. They specifically test modifiable SNPs that they can, you know, change with diet or with supplementation as a last resort. So it's definitely something that's on the horizon and should be, really, in combination with a whole bunch of other investigations, I think. So you get a real holistic picture of what might be better for someone's performance or overall well-being. But
well, essentially, this is a form of DNA testing that's been used across the world, Asia, Africa, United States, parts of Europe, and it was introduced to the UK last autumn. So it's called Trico test. And essentially, it's a DNA test where a swab is taken from inside both cheeks. An online questionnaire is completed, and the test is sent off to a laboratory in Spain. About 2 to 4 weeks later, you get the results back. Now, I've done a few of these tests with people so far, but what I tend to do is I do a very detailed consultation on top of the questionnaire that they've got as well, because it's quite new. We're still learning around the reports and what and the advice that we should give, which I know seems like a strange thing to say, considering that it's been so well established in other countries, but every country's got different forms of regulation. Yeah. So the algorithms that they use will be slightly different in different parts of the world. So essentially, the report comes back and it tells you about which treatments are more likely to work for certain hair loss conditions. So the recommendations are split into supplements and also into topical medications. With regards to the supplements, I sort of tell people, okay, this is what it recommends, but you can get this in your diet. I will always go down that route. Find my list of dietary foods that have these things, but from the prescribing point of view, some of these medications they're not necessarily commonly used in the UK at the moment, but they're seen as safe, and so it's just making sure that you don't waste time on treatments that aren't going to work.
Gotcha.
So, for example, not everybody responds to minoxidil or Regain, and we can. That's seen as so safe that you can actually literally just walk into a pharmacy and buy it. You can buy it from the internet. But for a significant proportion of people, it's just not going to work for them based on their genetic profile.
Yeah. So I heard it was like 50% or something like that, right?
I've read one paper where it's 40% at 6 months.
Oh, wow.
In men with balding. I suppose it will vary from population to population. But if you want... some people are prepared to spend 6 months using a medication once or twice a day, but not everybody is. So I think the great thing about this is that it saves time.
Yeah.
And what I've also found is that some of the male patients that come to me and they've had balding, almost all of them have tried minoxidil, but it hasn't, they've stopped taking it after a couple of months. And the reason why they've stopped taking it is because they've actually had excess hair shedding, which is actually a good sign in the long run. So the people that should have carried on taking it ended up stopping it too early. So that just, the genetic test really helps them to understand. And and also there is an enzyme that if people are low in it, you can switch it on. It's called sulfotransferase. Forgive me if I haven't explained this correctly, but there is there's a process that you can switch on for some people who've got a deficiency in this particular enzyme, which means that the minoxidil is more likely to work.
Oh, gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I'm proud to say that I actually got that into the algorithm in the UK.
Oh, did you?
Because I read one of these reports and I saw sulfotransferase and I realized that it hadn't yet been incorporated into the pathway. So I sent them the paper and they've now incorporated that into the pathway. But it makes a big difference because one of the alternatives is something called latanoprost. You're familiar with latanoprost for glaucoma?
Yeah.
Well, one of the happy side effects of it was that people grew long eyelashes.
Oh.
It's like with minoxidil. Minoxidil was for high blood pressure and people found that they grew excess hair.
Yeah.
So again, this is the wonders of medicine.
Yeah.
Most medicines have got more than one purpose. But latanoprost is quite expensive in the UK at the moment. So if you've got an alternative that you can use and you've got a fair idea that your genetic profile will favour it, then that's really good news.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, and I think the genetic profiling also saves a lot of money because minoxidil, even though if you can buy it over the counter, it's prohibitively expensive, particularly if you have to use it for months on end.
Yes.
And the time restriction as well. I mean, like doing it twice a day. I had some of my friends in medical school actually that were using minoxidil topically, and they were none the wiser as to whether it works or not. And I remember they sent me the paper that showed that, you know, it was a 40 or 50% or however many it was that it's beneficial for. So, you know, half of them wasted their money as a poor student and the other half were successful.
Absolutely. And it's funny how people internalize that experience, because I was doing a webinar just the other week, and a question came through about minoxidil, and it was, it doesn't work. It didn't work for me. Mm. And it could just, I said, well, it could be it's your genetic profile. Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of insights that we will gather from genetic profiling, particularly in pharmaceuticals in general, I think, for sure. I'm often bombarded with, I don't know why, but I've got loads of adverts for supplements for hair and stuff like that, including biotin. And some other ones that perhaps don't have as much evidence base. Are those ones that you ever recommend or get asked about at all?
I do get asked about biotin. And I would say it's one of those supplements where there's been a lot of noise about it. But actually, if you look at the evidence, there isn't any evidence for biotin supplements being beneficial in someone who hasn't got a biotin deficiency.
Gotcha.
Now, the thing about biotin is that it's almost throughout the diet. So it's really hard to be deficient in biotin. There are a couple of groups that are likely to be deficient. So there's a neonatal form of biotin deficiency, but this will present in the first 6 weeks of life.
Right.
So it's due to a holocarboxylase deficiency, and the child is born with no hair and a terrible skin rash, and so obviously you'll know straight off there's a problem. And then there's another type which presents at around 3 months, where it's due to a biotinase deficiency. But in adulthood, pregnant women are probably more likely to get a biotin deficiency, people with a gut absorption problem, but also people who eat raw egg whites.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't eat raw egg whites.
The reason why is because it contains a protein called avidin, and so that stops the biotin from being absorbed in the gut.
Oh.
But if your egg whites are cooked, that avidin is denatured by cooking.
Wow.
So raw egg whites. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Steer clear of raw egg whites.
Yes.
Luckily, none of my recipes have that. Actually, apart from whiskey sour, I do like a whiskey sour, and it's got whipped raw egg whites in, but nothing that's on my website.
I'm sure I'm sure it won't be to the level where you end up with a biotin deficiency.
No, probably not.
We hope.
Probably
not. But I think the other thing that people don't realise about biotin deficiency, and this is something that I've seen in some patients who have come to me and they've already been taking biotin supplements for some time, is that it can interfere with important blood tests. Yeah, so it can interfere with infectious diseases tests, hormone tests, cancer tests. Yeah, and more frighteningly, there is one case reported of somebody who had symptoms of heart attack, but his troponin T, which would be higher in a heart attack, was actually falsely low.
Oh.
So it got missed.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's one case that we know about. So there are probably people who have had, let's say, abnormal blood tests and not realised that it might have been down to the biotin interfering with the blood test.
Oh,
say.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's really scary.
It is, actually. Mm. It is. And it's funny.
Because routinely, I don't think, particularly in A&E, where you'd be having a TROP test, we don't usually ask about supplementation specifically.
No.
And I doubt any of my colleagues would know about biotin in particular.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised, people are taking a lot of it.
Yeah.
And when you're riding around on the tube, I've always been aware of that word biotin as a supplement. But most of the evidence around biotin is for nails.
Oh,
so
yeah, bristle nails.
It does. There is evidence that it improves brittle nails in people that haven't got a deficiency. And the few studies that have shown an improvement of hair growth, there's been some reason why they've had a biotin deficiency. It might have been some medication that they've been on or some
gotcha.
Health condition that they've got.
Oh, wow. Top tip there.
Mm.
that's really good to know. I mean, yeah, I'm cautious about supplementation in general, but that's made me even more cautious now.
It really did make me think about supplements. So when I sort of learned that fact about biotin supplements, I thought it's not a neutral thing recommending a biotin supplement. I think if I do say to somebody, look, I think you should take this supplement, but it's got biotin in, just be aware that it can affect your certain blood tests, then I think that will make people think actually before taking it. And if you can get your nutrients from your diet, that's
absolutely.
The safest way.
Yeah. And like you said, because it's just so, it's in everything pretty much. I mean, it's really hard to become deficient unless you have those enzyme deficiencies.
Yeah.
This is fascinating for me. I'm learning
really?
So
oh,
much
versus
it's brilliant. Graying hair.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So this is, again, I'm asked about this a lot. I'm getting a few greys, actually. I quite like my grey hairs. But a lot of people don't. And a lot of people have reached out to say, you know, they're greying in their 20s. And, you know, they don't have anything in their family history to suggest why, or they don't feel particularly stressed. But what is the mechanism behind grey hairs in general, and why might someone have more grey hairs than someone else?
Oh gosh, now we're getting very technical here. I mean, I suppose it's all to do with the melanin, and because grey hairs are really colourless hairs. But from the nutritional point of view, the strongest association has been low B12.
Gotcha.
And I think the biggest studies have been done in India, actually, and they looked at people who were prematurely greying over a period of 3 years.
Oh.
And they found the strongest associations were family history, a low B12, and abnormal thyroid function.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
But I think there is also a relationship with low selenium and low zinc as well.
Interesting. Mm. Okay. And with regard to selenium and zinc, actually, sorry I didn't ask you before, are those supplements that come out as recommendations in the genomic testing? Or
the selenium seems to come out as a recommendation.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yes. But again, having looked at the literature, I would say if you can get that from your general diet, do, because too much selenium can also be associated with hair loss as well.
Interesting. There's a fine balance with everything, I find.
It is, yes.
Yeah. There's a real sort of therapeutic window for everything, particularly when it comes to supplements. I always remember one of my professors from my nutritional master's, she was always adamant that you should be careful of your Brazil nuts, because Brazil nuts have a very, from those that are grown in China, I believe, have a very, very high concentration of selenium that can be toxic if you're munching on the Brazil nuts.
Really?
Yeah, it's to do with the soil.
Oh yeah.
And the amount of selenium that's in the soil.
Yes.
But I mean, I love Brazil nuts myself. I won't tell her that. But okay, that's brilliant. What about stress and greys?
Yes, there is an association as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose we all know the solution.
Yeah, because I know with stress, there's definitely a correlation with low B12.
Mm.
And whether that's because of an interference with absorption, which could then be related to the underlying process behind greying, that's something I find quite interesting. I probably need to look into that myself. But
there was some very interesting research published. I think it was at the beginning of the year, but I don't remember the details of it. But I think it was something to do with stress in mice or something.
Gotcha.
Turn their grey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll look into that. I mean, certainly laboratory mice, those that have been stressed for particular experiment or whatever, you do see graying hairs and stuff. So I'm sure that someone has looked into it, but I will look into that myself. I'd love to, I mean, there's a few Q&A things here that people ask about hair oils, and we've covered quite a few things actually, but I'd love to just go through your process of when you see a patient. So they come armed with maybe some images, an assessment, you know, some psychological elements to that as well. What's your next steps, and how do you guide someone through that process of improving their hair, whatever the hair issue is?
I also ask them to get a summary printout from their GP if they can as well, because you can get that free as part of GDPR now. So what we'll do now is we'll have an online consultation, and I'll go through the history of the hair loss condition, their past medical history, any medications that they're on, any supplements that they are using. We'll also look at ask questions about the family history, occupation, hobbies, pets, because again, that may be relevant.
Pets, really?
Yeah, sometimes Tinea capitis.
Oh, of course. Just for those who, it's a fungal infection that can lead to hair loss.
Yeah. Also, I'd look at their nutrition as well. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't sound like much, but it always takes about...
I know personally that is a lot of information to gather. Yeah.
And also, particularly for women, I'd go through their hair care practices. Mm. So what kinds of hairstyles have they worn? What kind of chemical processes have they used? Chemicals, straighteners, wigs, etc.
And pharmaceutical wise, what sort of options are there for people in terms of medications and other treatments?
It all depends on what I think the underlying cause is. Mm. So sometimes I might say to people, I suggest you go back to your GP and ask for these tests.
Gotcha.
Most of the time they do get done. I can prescribe a limited number of medications. So what I've had to do is with my insurer, I've had to sort of think about every hair loss condition I'm likely to prescribe for. And they give, they basically give the okay. So, so all the trichotest products I can prescribe for those situations. If the problem is more cosmetic, or if they want practical help about what to do, then I will also go down that route as well. Mm. So it will be simple things like what kind of products, what kind of cosmetic products can you use to camouflage your hair? Mm. So your hair loss rather. So there'll be sprays, there'll be fibers, mm. there'll be sort of products that you apply to the scalp that can reduce the show through of the scalp. Mm-hmm. I'll also give them advice about wigs and hair pieces because I've got a trade account with a wig supplier. Mm. So I've got a range of colours that I can show to people mm. as well. Mm. So it's just really to try and give people the whole service. Mm. I'm sure as things evolve, the model may change, but that's the model that I feel is the most ethical, I suppose.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. It's definitely mm. very holistic from the sounds of things. You know, you're going through yeah. all the different assessments and
I try and bring science into it as well. So mm. I will do a form of imaging that I've got access to called Tricholab. So essentially that looks at your hair growth using very objective parameters.
Oh, right.
Yeah, okay. They only work with doctors. So oh, right. You can send a report, you take the images and they're downloaded and they're looked at. I believe the center is in Poland mm. and you've got hair experts who are also able to give a second opinion as well if there's any doubt. And also the clinic offers platelet-rich plasma treatment mm. as well. Mm. And there is evidence of subtle benefit for telogen effluvium hair shedding, male and female pattern hair loss as well.
Interesting. Yeah. And with that Tricholab, what kind of things can they help with the diagnosis of?
Loads, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Most hair loss conditions.
Really?
Yes. I've put a list of all of the hair loss conditions that they're likely to help in the diagnosis of.
Yeah, because yeah. at the moment, from my understanding, it's from the clinical history.
Yes, but
which is always going to be very important, right? Yeah.
That's very important. I think that's also why they only work with doctors as mm. well. I mean, no disrespect to trichologists because they've got a really good understanding of mm. of common hair loss conditions, mm. but obviously we've been trained to take a history in more detail.
Yeah.
But yes, it's quite a long list of hair loss conditions that they can help yeah. with. And I suppose what's reassuring is that I've got a few books on dermoscopy and the authors of one, there are a couple of names that keep coming up in who author these books
yeah.
and they are involved with this project as well.
Oh,
so
okay.
So that's very reassuring.
Yeah, it's got almost like a seal of approval.
Yeah, because I suppose I'm in this weird middle ground because I'm not a dermatologist. Mm-hmm. I'm basically a GP who's done trichology training. Mm. So I've kind of extended that one part of being a GP that tries to marry trichology with with general practice.
Yeah, which is why I think it's really important that actually, because being a GP and having that foundational knowledge, you have experience of and you're knowledgeable about a range of different conditions that can be underlying for a number of different hair complaints, whether mm. it be autoimmune, whether it be endocrinological, whether it be women's health related, etc. Mm. So I think that's super important.
Mm.
From my perspective, I think it's almost like a benefit.
it is a benefit, but I suppose sometimes it's the boundaries as well.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you think, oh, you've got a problem there that you need to get sorted out. Mm. And encouraging them to go and visit their GP again to get a certain problem sorted out mm. that is likely to be affecting their hair loss.
Definitely. Mm. I wanted to touch on alopecia areata specifically, actually. Mm. It's reassuring to note that 80% of cases will revert.
Mm.
What time period is that over? And there are some treatments like cortisone injections, anything to reduce the local inflammation.
Mm.
Are those things that you think have benefits at all? Or is it just a case of reassurance, monitoring, and making sure that you've got the correct diagnosis?
It's always a difficult one to call, isn't it? Mm. I think it's 80% at about a year.
Okay.
And when I think back to my GP consultations, and you know, you get your e-miss printout, which sort of, because I love their patient information leaflets. So I think they're really important.
I think they're brilliant. Yeah.
And so you kind of weigh up, what do you want to do about this? Do you want to just wait for it to go? Mm. We could try some topical steroids. Dermatologists do speak very positively about steroid injections.
Yeah.
Again, this is something that Trichotest does pick up. It does actually look at different types of steroid, topical steroid treatments, not steroid injections, but it actually does look at steroid treatments for alopecia areata as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. But I think my approach is that if it's very severe, I would recommend seeing a dermatologist straight off.
Yeah.
Because there's some very exciting new developments in the world of alopecia areata. Yeah. The JAK inhibitors, they are very, very potent new medications that have had quite very significant drastic effects in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not risk-free, but I wouldn't want to deprive somebody of that opportunity. I would say, look, if your alopecia areata is very severe and it's come on really rapidly, I would get a referral to a dermatologist.
Absolutely.
In the pipeline very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there's definitely an association, like we alluded to earlier, with a number of different autoimmune conditions, one of which is celiacs that I've heard of. And that's why for some people who have recognized celiacs, a gluten-free diet is obviously going to improve their gut issues, but it may have an impact on their hair as well. Where it gets murky is this non-celiac gluten sensitivity and whether a gluten-free diet might be beneficial for those types of patients.
Oh, I don't know. I honestly don't know. That's probably what I should go on to Medline about and have a look. But it's not a question that's come up, but it's a very interesting one though.
Yeah, I think so. I just think, you know, the whole area around autoimmune conditions, there's so many associations that I've seen anecdotally that make me believe that, you know, stress is involved, nutritional deficiencies are involved, whether you know there are intolerances, and again, this has to be personalized to the patient. Not everyone is going to benefit from a nutritional intervention or a collection of other things. Sometimes you do need the hard medications and the harder sort of pharmaceuticals. They're there for a reason. So it's definitely about giving everyone the opportunity. I agree. Absolutely. Dry scalp. Is that something that you see at all, and I'm assuming that's related to the quality of
not really. I suppose when people come and see me, they've really had a problem, so I think lots of people get dry scalp now and again, so they'll manage it themselves, so it's not really something that I see much of. It's more scaly scalp.
Gotcha.
And that was something that came up at the beginning of lockdown as well, because I think with all the uncertainty over people's jobs, that was incredibly stressful for people. And so they began to experience problems with very, very scaly scalps. And again, that's something a GP can manage. But for certain hair types, it's the products are not always suitable. They can be very drying for afro-textured hair. So what I normally tend to do is recommend alternative options, and also alert people to what can actually be prescribed in primary care.
Yeah.
Because a lot of trichologists, they can supply various scalp products to help with scaly scalps. Coconut oil, I think, is something that seems to have many uses. The only downside of it is that it can run down the face and that sort of thing, but it's got lots of positive benefits.
I actually personally use coconut oil.
Do you?
A very small amount, tiny amount on my hair after I wash it, because I've noticed whatever product I use, whatever shampoo I use, it always dries out my hair. So yeah. I can't believe I'm admitting this on the podcast. But yeah, tiny bit of coconut. I swear by that. And I've been using that for years. But again, yes. For other people, it might clog up the scalp. It might be too heavy for them. Like it might run down your, you know, all these different things.
I suppose it depends on the phase of your hair washing that you use it. Because for people with afro textured hair, it's useful to use it before you actually start washing. Prevent what they call hygral fatigue. Hygral, H-Y-G-R-A-L fatigue. So it's kind of fatigue that's of the strand that's due to washing and makes the hair weak. So a lot of people recommend doing that before washing the hair.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But coconut oil is supposed to help with hair graying as well, I believe.
Oh, really? Mm. Oh, interesting. Mm. Okay, I'll look into that.
I'm still fighting the fight.
Same here. I mean, I'm going grey despite the coconut oil. So. You mentioned something there about Afro-Caribbean hair and products that might be more useful for them with scaly scalp. What are those in particular?
I don't want to give away all of my trade secrets. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. But there are certain brands that have the necessary therapeutic ingredients that aren't as drying.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Nod, wink, wink.
I can't give away all my secrets.
No, of course. You want to make sure we've got people coming to see you.
Well, it's all about personalised treatments.
I agree.
As well. Yeah. So there are a few, but, you know, ketoconazole is often the first line, but it's incredibly drying.
Mm.
I mean, the ones that I tend to recommend second, and these are available from the GP over the counter, Capsel, Dermax.
Yeah.
They're nice, easy, straightforward ones. But say if those don't work, then there are other alternatives as well.
Do you ever use coal tar at all in those who don't have psoriasis of the scalp?
I haven't personally used it.
Okay.
No, but Capsel has got coal tar in it.
Yeah. Okay, a couple other questions from people, because I was inundated with questions, honestly, as you can imagine. So we talked about hair oils in particular. Any other hair oils that you're aware of? Like, I mean, but in India, I say in India, my dad always used almond oil for his hair when he has long hair, and he used to swear by almond oil.
Yeah.
But everyone has their own sort of, you know.
Yes, it's I must admit, it's something that I probably will need to look into in a bit more detail. It's not a big part of what I do, but I suppose it is a question that comes up. So,
Postpartum hair loss.
Mm.
Is that something you come
across? Yes, I do see that. Yes, yeah. I think the big shock is that when women become pregnant, their hair continues to grow, and so they have lush, thick hair, and often the hairdresser is the first person to notice that they might be pregnant. and then after they've had the shock of giving birth, and I suppose the sleepless nights and things like that, then they do notice that they get that sudden shedding of hair.
Mm.
And again, as with all kinds of telogen effluvium, you get that shedding.
Gotcha.
I think in most cases it resolves as long as you're nutritionally in balance.
Yeah.
So a lot of women, they come out of pregnancy anemic.
Yeah.
So making sure that things like that are sorted out, and obviously vitamin D levels are okay as well.
Mm.
Is really important.
We're going to do an episode, I think, on breastfeeding and postpartum nutrition.
Okay.
Because I think certainly, I'd like to hope that most people understand that when a woman is breastfeeding, their calorie requirements go right up.
Mm.
So I think perhaps there is a way in which, if you are undernourishing yourself and your hair is a luxury item on your body, you're going to potentially impact that hair cycle that could lead to
telogen effluvium. Yes.
Potentially that's related, but particularly women who are breastfeeding, you know, there's a few nutritional considerations, vitamin D, iron, and a whole bunch of others as well. So we should definitely, I mean, it's a whole other podcast in itself. This is a big subject. there's so much we've covered here.
Okay, that's good.
it's been a real educational experience for me as well.
Oh, good.
I mean, as you know, as a GP, we're not taught nutrition, let alone, you know, nutrition for hair or about too much about hair conditions. Mm. So I think I really appreciate your time coming down here and talking about this.
You're very welcome.
We're going to link to all your sort of clinics and you've got online consultations.
I do, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Brilliant. I think that's fantastic for people all over the country who can, you know, come and get your trade secrets, but also have that sort of real holistic consultation with that scientific edge as well. I think it's super, super important. Mm. So, you know, I can't wait to support that. So,
Well, thank you very much. Because it's a journey for people sometimes as well. So, so I don't charge for follow-ups.
Yeah.
As long as people come back within 6 months or they contact me within 6 months, because I think it's sometimes things will come into their mind that they haven't thought of.
Yeah.
And hair loss can really, really weigh people down.
That's brilliant. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story as well. I think it's super powerful.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Please do check out the links to Crew Hair and Skin Clinic.uk. Dr. Ingrid is seeing patients online, so you can access her wherever you are in the country. Do follow her on social media. I've put the links on the podcast show notes at thedoctorskitchen.com. I really hope you learned a lot from this episode. I certainly did. This is an area that I haven't actually spent that much time thinking or looking into. But if I were to summarize the conversation that we had, it is making sure that your diet is nutritionally replete, and you can achieve that using principles for healthy eating. Good quality fats, lots of fiber, plenty of plant-based items, having it plant-focused, lots of different variety and diversity in your diet as well as eating in time. We didn't really talk about that today, but it's certainly one of the principles that I adhere to, as it helps stabilize sugars, and that can have a whole bunch of other downstream effects too. If you want to learn a bit more about that, then please do check out thedoctorskitchen.com. Sign up to the newsletter, where we give recipes every single week and lots of tips to help you live the healthiest, happiest life. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this, and I'll catch you here next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.